I don't have to ask you to raise your hands because I know you do, but you all know Jimmy Swaggart. Right? Well, as you know, he was one of the most probably famous televangelists that there was in the 1980s. And he preached passionately about morality. He often condemned sins like adultery and for sexual immorality. His television ministry reached millions. If you think about back in the 80s, millions of viewers worldwide that knew who he was. And he became a very powerful figure in the evangelical community. Schweigert was known for his emotional sermons. And I don't know if you ever watched him. I saw him on occasion, not just because I wanted to watch him, flipping through the channels, and I'd see him, and I think, I want to see what this guy's saying. You know, and he was a very, I guess, emotional speaker, at least from what I could say. And he often called out other pastors, other men, for their moral failings and urging his followers to live righteously. However, in 1988, he was caught in a scandal when it revealed that he had been involved with a prostitute. The revelation was shocking because Schweigert had publicly criticized other ministers for similar behavior. So after the scandal broke, Schweigert delivered a tearful, I guess you could say, confession on television saying, I have sinned against you, Lord. And I bring this out, and I know I mentioned his name, but it was already on the news. It's been out there. It's been years ago, but I felt it was safe to talk about it now. But he regretted what he had done, or was it just because he was caught? Despite his admission, the hypocrisy was evident. He had condemned others for sins that he was secretly committing himself. And so the fallout from that scandal was severe for him. He was defrocked from the assemblies of God, and his ministry never fully recovered from that, as you can imagine. Yet despite the public disgrace and despite what happened to him, Schweigert continued preaching. Though under a cloud of distrust and really damaged credibility. Now, maybe you have known someone who has been a hypocrite. Maybe yourself, you have been a hypocrite. I can look back in my life and say, yes, I have been. I've been a hypocrite. I've been a victim of hypocrisy in my life. And I think this story illustrates how hypocrisy, especially when it's among leadership and leaders, can damage not only the personal relationships that you might have with other people, but also the faith and trust of others. And so, as we come into the spring holy days, I believe that this directly falls in line with what Jesus warned the disciples about and warns us about, and that is what? The leaven of the Pharisees. Right? The leaven of the Pharisees, appearing righteous on the outside, looking like they're righteous, doing what looks right and what looks good, but harboring sin on the inside. So let's begin in Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. In verse 1, Luke chapter 12 and verse 1, and it says, in the meantime, when the innumerable multitude of people had gathered together, so that they had trampled one another, so this had to be a very large group, wasn't it? If they're trampling one another, innumerable multitude, you know, as the sands of the sea, you know, can't count, a lot of people are there. And it says, he began to say to his disciples, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. So hypocrisy is really what we call not living by the standards that they preach, right? Not living by what they're saying. So there's this you could call it, I would say, hidden leaven. Hidden sins, right? Leaven is sin. Something hiding there that you're not willing to bring out, that you don't want to admit. And so they present this image of purity, of self-control, and their actions undermine the very message that they're trying to bring, right? That they're trying to promote. So as we saw with Jimmy Swaggart, the hidden hypocrisy gradually, as you know sin does, as you know leaven does, gradually seeped into the followers' thinking, creating confusion sometimes, and creating mistrust. Just as yeast, just as leaven, spreads through dough, the leaven of hypocrisy, right? Hypocrisy spreads and can eventually cause others to become disillusioned. Right? Disillusioned with the principles that they maybe had once held high. I can think of a time in my life when that happened, and you can all too, in the late 90s or mid-90s, when we were part of the Worldwide Church of God. A lot of people were disillusioned because of what happened. And there was a lot of hypocrisy involved in that, if you go back and look through those things. But similarly here, these Pharisees were outwardly righteous, but inwardly corrupt. And so we're going to look at this today, and we have a physical hypocrisy. We're going to see that today. We also have a spiritual hypocrisy that we need to focus on. Jesus warns us to beware, to understand this type of behavior because it subtly influences not just us, but it can influence those around us. It can influence our hearts. It influences our minds, leading us to become more concerned, probably, with the outward appearances. Right? Our outward appearance than true integrity and sincerity, which comes from God. Now, I don't know what it is about human beings, about us, that we have to be, why are we so worried about what other people think? Why is it we have to be look good on the outside? What is it that, what are we trying to impress? Who are we trying to impress? The only person you should try to impress is God. So what does anybody else matter? I think we need to look at that when we're looking at this hypocrisy, when we're looking at what it is that God is trying to get us to learn from this lesson. It doesn't matter what anybody else thinks or sees. It's what God sees. And God sees everything, right? But he normally looks to the heart. And we're going to look at that as we go through this. Now we know hypocrisy is a common word for all of us. We all know what that means. At least I hope we do. And we could all probably give some kind of illustration of what it looks like. Well, in the day of Jesus Christ, when he was speaking and he was talking about this hypocrisy, it had somewhat of a different meaning or origin. I mean, it's the same word, so I'm not saying it's different in that way, but it had a different origin, I guess is a better way to say it, because its origin was rooted in the Greek theatrical world. The Bible definition of hypocrisy, I'm going to read this for you, the biblical definition, comes from the Greek word hypokrisis, which originally referred to the act of playing a part. So you see theatrical, right? We go back to the Greek, theatrical, or acting on stage. In the biblical sense, hypocrisy means pretending to have moral or spiritual qualities that one does not actually possess. It involves presenting an outward appearance of righteousness while inwardly being sinful or dishonest. Now, there are levels of hypocrisy that Christ, well, at least from Christ's perspective, and I think when we look at some of these things today, we're going to see too, there are levels of hypocrisy sometimes we don't even see. So I'd like to go back now to the Sermon on the Mount. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 6. Because this is where Christ really began his instruction to his disciples about the subject of hypocrisy. Matthew chapter 6, we're going to begin in verse 1. Matthew chapter 6, verse 1. says, take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Now we know the story of, well, a lot of stories we can turn to, and I'll mention one here in a little bit, but of people who want people to know how much they gave, because that's important to them, that to see, you know that I gave this much. And again, that's our human nature, but he goes on here, says, otherwise you have no reward from your Father in heaven. It says, therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before as you have, as the hypocrites do, in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Again, all to be seen, all to get praise and accolades. Wow, you did a good, that's really awesome. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. So here, this is the first instruction Christ gave about hypocrisy. He said, let your charitable deed, offerings, if you want to call it that, be in secret, so that the Father can reward you openly. So this hypocrisy here is about motivation, isn't it? Doing the right thing for the wrong reason. This was their motivation. Doing the right thing for the wrong reason. We're going to talk more about that as we go through this. But here the Pharisees were giving, well, I guess you say, giving the appearance of being righteous rather than showing the genuine love towards others. Jesus teaches that true righteousness isn't about public recognition. That's not what it's about, but about sincerity before God, being true to God, being honest with God, being honest with yourself. God cares about the heart, and we've talked about that many, many times in the sermons, haven't we? About the heart. God knows the heart. God sees the heart. And so that's where it has to be. That action from the heart is more, God is concerned more about it than just the action itself. Christ then moves on to the second example here, the second instruction in verse 5. He says, when you pray, you shall not be like the hypocrites. Again, all about hypocrites. Hypocrisy. He says, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners and on the streets, that they may be seen by men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. And maybe you've seen that also. I have seen that many times. People standing out in a corner, standing in public, making sure people see them pray. Why? Because it makes them feel more righteous? I mean, God says, do it in secret. So just like the charitable giver and charitable giving that we just talked about, the issue is of the heart behind the action. The heart behind the action. The Pharisees were doing the right outward thing, right? They were praying. That's a good thing. Prayer is always good. God says we should pray. We want to pray to our Father. We want to have communication with him. But the wrong reason, right? The wrong reason, but seeking praise from others. And Jesus warns of that type of hypocrisy then leads to an empty spiritual life, because they were seeking approval from men rather than the relationship with God. Again, I may be a little strong on that, but who cares about what other people think? I don't. I only care about God and what God thinks about me and what God says about me. Now, are there times when I act inappropriately and I want to be told? Yes, indeed. And my wife does tell me. So in that case, it is important to me. But I hope you understand what I'm saying. And we're going to go some more into that. True prayer is about intimacy with God, not impressing others. And Jesus later explains that prayer should be done with sincerity, with truth, or truthfulness, and humility, right? On our knees before God is humility, focusing on God rather than how others might perceive us. So God listens to the heart, not the performance. Right? Not the performance. And included in that particular instruction that Christ talks about here is the model prayer. We're not going to go through that right now, but that's what he ends up going through. So after telling him how to give offerings, telling him how that we should pray, he then goes into the third thing, and that's fasting. Verse 16, of Matthew 6 says, "Moreover, when you fast, do not be like the hypocrites." You kind of get the running theme here, don't we? "With the sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces that they may appear to men to be fasting. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, so that you do not appear to men to be fasting, but to your Father who is in the secret place, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly." Now, I've experienced that myself as well. And I've actually come up to a person, not here, not any of the congregations I'm talking to right now, but another congregation, and said, "Are you okay? You don't look right." "Oh, I'm fasting today." Well, good for you. I mean, why did you have to tell me that? It's a secret. It's supposed to be with you and God. Nobody else needs to know that. It says here, wash your face, clean up, and be like normal. Nobody should know you're fasting. Right? That's what it says here. The Pharisees pretended to be deeply spiritual. And I think sometimes we as human beings do the same thing. We are, we are like the Pharisees in ways. Through the exaggerated displays of fasting. But their motivation was not about seeking God. That's not what their purpose was. It was about seeking recognition. Again, do you see what I'm doing? You know, I had somebody, let's just forget that. Let's move on. It was a false humility. Right? A false humility. Jesus teaches that fasting, like prayer and giving that we're talking about here, should be about the heart's relationship with God. Where's it coming from? Not impressing others. Now, I'm not giving the sermon to say you all are doing that. That's not the point. There's lessons here that I think that we all can learn from. Lessons that we should be thinking about as we come to the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. True fasting, as you know, is about humbling oneself before God. Not gaining, I guess you could say, admiration from people. And Jesus is teaching that the reward for sincerely fasting comes from God, right? Comes from Him, not human applause. I mean, if somebody, people stood around applauding all the time, would you fast more? I doubt it. When fasting is done privately and sincerely, God rewards us, doesn't He? Because it comes from the heart. We go to God fasting usually is humbling. We humble ourselves, right? And we go to God for what? Help. I can't get this to work. This is not falling. I can't change myself. I can't do these things. So you fast. You humble yourself before God with prayer and fasting so that God will help you. That's why we do those things. That's why we do that. And again, the only time we have to fast, I should say that, is atonement. Right? You're not required to fast any other time of the year. But we should, shouldn't we? Because if you don't, does that mean you don't have any problems? Well, I think we all have problems, don't we? We all need God's help. We all need that kind of thing. So what is the overall theme? What are we really talking about? Well, we're talking about when we come to these spring holy days and when we are giving our offering. And it's, well, let's just talk about that first. It's nobody's business of what you give. And I think that we do really well at that. I think we turn our envelopes upside down and we don't want people to know. And I don't think we should know. Because it's none of their business. Right? None of their business. No one needs to know what you put in the basket. Whether it's $20 or $1,000. It's between you and God. Do you remember the widow and the mite? She gave the least, but she gave the most. Because it was all that she had. So there's no bragging rights for those who, oh, look at me, I give this or I give that. It doesn't matter what you give. You have the right heart when giving and the right attitude. God sees it as better than anything else. Well, we'll look at prayer. Prayer is the same way, isn't it? When you and I pray, we don't stand out in public and pray. Now, we might pray in public during certain occasions. And I know that we've done that as a church. One of those instances would be when we dedicated the new building, back when we first got our new building. And they'll probably do it when we finish the other part of this building that we get finished. Thanking God for allowing us to have this wonderful tool for the church. And I've also done it on occasion when somebody either has gotten injured or fainted or something right on the spot. And maybe it's right during church. And we've gotten down and we've anointed them in public with everybody around and prayed. Those are a couple of instances that we don't do it all the time, but we do do it. But we don't do it to be seen by others. Right? We do it for the person and for God. Well, then let's go to fasting. We don't make ourselves look physically miserable because we're fasting. Now, I may look miserable when I'm fasting, but I try not to make myself look that way. I mean, right, we all clean up, we wash, just like we do on a regular day, and we try to look just day as, you know, the day is normal, and we may be fasting. Except when it comes to the Day of Atonement, right? That's a day we have to fast. You know, and I will just say this, there are some exceptions to the rules with some people because some people do get ill fasting. They do. And, you know, sometimes that's unavoidable. It is unavoidable. And I will bring up my wife about this one. I did get permission first before I did say this. So I just told her on the way, I'm going to bring you up today. And she said, what are you going to say? Oh, you'll hear. You'll know when I say it. No. I told her. But years ago, she got, I don't want to say deathly ill, but she got really, really sick on atonement. I mean, where it was not just a migraine, it was other things. And it lasted all evening, and I mean, it was horrible for her. And so we find out that she didn't have her coffee that day. Those of you who are coffee drinkers probably know what I'm talking about. You don't have a cup of coffee, and you get a headache if you don't have it. Well, hers was very severe. And so after that, now she drinks 4 or 5 cups of coffee before Passover, before atonement, and that gets her through, and she's usually fine and no worries. So her body's just craving that caffeine that she wasn't giving it. So, you know, what's the obvious solution? Stop drinking coffee. Slow down, cut back, and then cut it out all eventually. Yeah, right. I'm not going to do that, and I know my wife's not. But I'm just saying there are things that do happen, and it may be also other things that you're doing. Maybe there's medication you're taking or you have to take or certain things that get you sick. But the main thing is that we aren't making ourselves look that way for other people, right? We're to be doing it ourselves between you and God and what your heart is. Let's go to Matthew 22 now. Matthew 22. Again, I was talking about earlier that their hypocrisy has many faces and many different things that we can look at. And they range from the most obvious, which there's some hypocrisy we can say, man, you're a hypocrite. You can just see it. I mean, it's, but there's others that is so subtle that you can't see it. Virtually indiscernible, but it's there. So Matthew 22 and verse 15. Here we have, this is Jesus Christ. Here we have the Pharisees and Sadducees trying to plot against him. So here in verse 15, it says, then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk. So, right away, we see that there's motive. Heart, right? Comes from the heart. There's a motive. And we want to trip him up. We want to discredit him. That's what they're thinking. That's their whole reason for doing this. Verse 16 says, and they sent him to the disciples, sent to him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, teacher, we know that you are true. Wow, big suck up here. We know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth. Nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men. So we see here the Pharisees and the Herodians were trying to set a trap for Christ in order that he can, you know, mess him up, right? And their goal was to force him into a political or theological, I guess you could say, mistake regarding, as we're going to look here, taxes going to Caesar, right? However, their approach itself was hypocritical. Their approach, you have to look at the undermeaning, the underlying thing that they're doing here. They spoke words of flattery. We know you're true, right? I mean, they're just, it's like, yuck. But they're spitting it out there, but they're secretly plotting against him. Verse 17 says, tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? why was this a trap? Why was this a trap? Because if Jesus Christ said, yes, pay taxes to Caesar, if he said that, then the Pharisees could accuse him of siding with Rome, right? Siding with Rome, betraying the Jewish people, which they despise anyway. They despise Rome. The Jews did. And if he said, no, don't pay taxes, then what happens? The Herodians, who supported Rome, who did everything for Rome, could accuse him of rebellion against the government. So either answer could be used against him, making the classic example of deceitful hypocrisy. Pretending to seek wisdom, right? They were pretending to seek wisdom while actually trying to destroy him. So it's one of those scenarios, if you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Moving on, verse 18. But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, why do you test me, you hypocrites? I mean, he saw right through them. Show me the tax money. So they brought him a denarius, and he said to them, whose image is on the inscription in this? And they said to him, Caesar's. And he said to them, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Now, we just saw a sophisticated exercise in the practice of hypocrisy. The Pharisees and Herodians tried to trap Jesus about the question of paying taxes to Caesar. I mean, they seemed legit, right? They seemed like they really wanted to know. They buttered him up. And Jesus of Christ, of course, knowing their hypocrisy, called him out on it when he asked for that denarius. And when he confirmed that coin bore Caesar's image, he gave a profound response which exposed their deceit. Right? Their deceit. Their wrong way of thinking, their true heart. And he avoided their trap. So Jesus affirmed that worldly obligations, and we've heard this, we've talked about this, people have asked this before, you know, again, like taxes, they should be met. Our government, we follow our government unless it goes against what God teaches, right? We follow those laws. Because why? Our ultimate allegiance belongs to God. That's where his image is born. With us. We bear his image. God. Now, this incident that we just talked about is really, when we look at it, case specific. Okay? It was case specific. The accusers of hypocrisy relate to the actions that were going on in that particular time, what they were doing then and there. Now we wouldn't have that, well, who we pay taxes to. I mean, it was case specific. But I think it's still very instructional for us to see that hypocrisy can be very subtle, can be very, well, you can't discern it is actually happening. And it's ungodly to set someone up, and that's what Christ is talking about here, of showing specifically of showing malice towards them. Okay, so we've seen that hypocrisy is and was the leaven of the Pharisees. But is there more? Is hypocrisy the only answer? You know, when you ask a question, what is the leaven of the Pharisees? Is it just hypocrisy? Is there more than that? Well, let's go to Matthew 16. Matthew chapter 16. In verse 1. Matthew 16 and verse 1. Then the Pharisees and Sadducees came, and testing him, asked that he should show them a sign from heaven. He answered and said to them, when it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be foul weather today, for the sky is red and threatening. Hypocrites! You know how to discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the sign of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign shall be given except the sign of the prophet Jonah. And then he left them and departed. Now, you look at here, and you have the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They were usually rivals. But here you see them, they come together, join forces to test Jesus, and they demanded a sign from heaven. Prove it to us, right? They really wanted him to prove his authority, is what they were trying to do. And instead of granting their request, Jesus exposed their hypocrisy, pointing out that they could predict the weather by looking up in the sky, looking at what was going on, but failed to recognize the spiritual signs of his coming. So he rebuked them, as he does, and said, "You wicked and adulterous generation." And he stated that the only sign they were going to see is what? The sign of Jonah, which is what? The reference to his death and his resurrection. Well, then, of course, he departed. Verse 5 goes on to say, "Now when his disciples had come to the other side, they had forgotten to take bread." So as Jesus Christ and his disciples crossed over to the other side of the river, or the sea, the disciples forgot to bring bread. Now what are they going to do? I want you to think about this as we go into this, right? They forgot to bring bread. While that seemed like a small concern to them, it probably a big concern to them, it really set the stage for Jesus Christ teaching a deeper spiritual lesson about leaven, right? False teachings of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So the disciples worry over this physical bread, right? Because they forgot to bring it. And that mirrored their physical tendency to focus on the material concerns rather than trusting in Jesus Christ, rather than looking to him for provision. Despite having witnessed all his miracles, despite witnessing everything that he had done for them, like feeding the thousands, this moment also contrasted with the Pharisees, who also demanded a sign. We want a sign, while ignoring the clear evidence of Jesus' power. I mean, it's pretty amazing when you look at what they were doing and how they were doing these things. Let's move on to verse 6. It says, "Then Jesus said to them, 'Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees.' And they reasoned among themselves, saying, 'Is it because we have taken no bread?'" Now we just, they saw him feed. Well, we're going to get to that. Let me just keep going. "But Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, 'O you of little faith, why do you reason among yourselves because you have brought no bread? Do you not yet understand or remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? Nor the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how much many large baskets you took up. How is it you do not understand that I do not speak about concerning bread, but to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees?'" The disciples misunderstood his words and assumed he was rebuking them for forgetting the bread. And yet he had just, out of a few loaves, fed 4,000, 5,000. Did they really need the physical bread? No. But that's what they were stuck on. They couldn't get their mind off of that. He questioned why they were still worried about this physical bread. What are you thinking? And they missed that spiritual lesson he was trying to show them. So Jesus rebuked their lack of faith, didn't he? "Oh, you of little faith." Reminding them how he had, again, fed all those thousands of people. What happened between now and then? What happened to your faith? Verse 12, it says, "Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." Of the doctrine, of the teaching. So we said, the leaven of the Pharisees is hypocrisy. But now, we're looking and we're saying, oh, it's the teaching. It's the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So the disciples finally understood that Jesus Christ was not talking about this literal bread, but about the corruption and that corrupting influence that the Pharisees and Sadducees had in their teachings and what they were doing. So their doctrine, like leaven, right, their teaching, could quietly spread and lead people from the way of truth. Lead them from truth into something else. And so this moment here highlights how spiritual awareness, and I guess you could say our discernment, right? Being spiritually aware, discerning, takes time to develop. You know, I don't know about you, but I pray for discernment, that God will help me with my discernment so I can see things, I can recognize things, I can understand things. But we need Jesus Christ to do that and God the Father to develop that in us. And you can see how Jesus Christ patiently guided his disciples toward a deeper understanding. Patiently. But it also serves us as a warning, doesn't it? That false teaching is subtle. That false teaching is dangerous, and it requires discernment to recognize it and avoid it. You know, a guilty conscience and a focus on material concerns can cloud spiritual understanding. But we know that faith in Christ brings clarity. It brings understanding. So we see there was more than one Pharisaical leaven. More than one. One was an attitude. Right? Was an attitude that that particular group of people carried with them as hypocritical. And the other was the teaching base or the doctrine. Their teaching. Let's go to Mark chapter 7. Mark chapter 7. And we're going to look at this doctrine, or the doctrinal side of the leaven of the Pharisees. How's that? We're going to look at that for a minute. And this is one of those cases where the Pharisees caught the disciples eating without having gone through the necessary rituals. And you probably know what those rituals are. They were sitting down and they were eating, but they hadn't gone through the ritual cleansing that the Pharisees thought they should have. So here in Mark 7, verse 1, it says, "Then the Pharisees had some of the scribes, and some of the scribes came together to him, having come from Jerusalem. And now when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is, unwashed hands, they found fault." No. I was raised by my mother to wash our hands before every meal. And we'll get to that here in a minute. Do I do it still? Yes, most of the time. Not always. I mean, when I'm out working, doing whatever, I don't wash my hands. There's no place to wash me. I eat. I figure whatever germs there, I'm going to develop a tolerance for. But anyway, we'll get to that here in a little bit. Wash hands, they fall in fault. "For the Pharisees and all of the Jews did not eat unless they washed their hands in a special way, holding the tradition of the elders." Wow. In a special way. So, you know, what would that be? You wash your right hand before your left hand? Or you put your one over the other one and then under the other one? And, you know, what is in the world would you come up with something like? But anyway, this wasn't about hygiene, right? My mom taught us to wash our hands for hygiene. That was the purpose. This is not about hygiene, but about ritual purity. Again, being seen. How spiritual, how righteous are you because you wash in a ritualistic way, in a ritualistic manner? And the Pharisees had actually elevated this to a religious requirement. Their traditions had become so ingrained that they valued them above God's commandments. Do we do that sometimes today? Are there things that we know are commanded by God and those things that maybe aren't? That maybe it's a tradition, but yet we get so hung up on the tradition that we make it almost a law. I know that there are things because I've heard it. I'm not going to bring them up at this time. But there are. That we make traditions higher than law. We make them law. And we shouldn't. They should not be above God's commandments. These external rituals more important than true righteousness. Let's move on to verse 4. Verse 4 says, when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other things which they received and hold, like the washing of cups, pitchers, copper vessels, and couches. I've never washed my couch. Now, maybe that's something different here. I don't know what that means, this word. I should have looked it up. It goes on to say, then the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, why do your disciples not walk according to the traditions of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands? Oh, it's almost a sin. That's what they would think, right? They would think that was wrong. That's what they're thinking. It's a sin. Their worship was empty because they prioritize human traditions over the devotion to God. Now think about that. When we come up to the Spring Holy Days, think about those things, about the leaven of the Pharisees, hypocrisy, about doctrine, about teachings. Verse 7, it says, and in vain they worship me, teaching there's a doctrine to the commandments of men. Instead of leading people closer to God, as the example we're supposed to be, their teachings created a false sense of righteousness, replacing divine commandments with man-made rules. Going on to verse 8, it says, for laying aside the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men. The washing of pitchers and cups and many other such things you do. He said to them, all too well you reject the commandment of God that you may keep your tradition. He's telling them that you actually set aside what God had required in order to uphold their man-made religious, whatever you want to call it, system. Instead of obeying God's law, instead of obeying God's righteousness, they twisted it to their own agenda, making it sound like, well, that's we're commanded to do that. No, it's a tradition. Not really. Nothing in the Bible says we're commanded to do that. That's something we have to think about as God's people, even now, today, in our lives and what we do. Their teachings led people into a false sense of righteousness, making this outward rule-keeping more important than the true obedience in faith. So here in this case, he really literally combines hypocrisy with doctrine into one. That's what he's doing here. He said, you hypocrites, your doctrine is what you're doing in a hypocritical nature. You know, if you look up the word Pharisee, it means a separated one. Someone who is special. Oh, yeah, they're special. So special. You all know what I'm talking about. Who is not contaminated by the masses. Pharisee, who's not contaminated by the masses. They set themselves up as holier than the community. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? Holier than the community. Holier than the people around them. Better and more righteous than those surrounding them. And it was for the reason Christ said that they were hypocritical. Christ basically says, when you claim to be holy, the only justification for holiness is my law. My law. But when your traditions contradict my laws and you do your traditions first, I see that as hypocritical. I see your doctrines and hypocrisy in this case are literally synonymous. They go together. Well, as we continue on, in Matthew 23, and I'm not going to, for time's sake, turn there, but I am going to, in Matthew 20, he describes this, he delivers a scathing, I guess you could say it, rebuke to the Pharisees in Matthew 23, exposing their hypocrisy, exposing their pride, their spiritual corruption. He does all that in Matthew 23. And he publicly denounces them for their false righteousness, warning the people not to follow their example. Don't do as they do. And some have referred to this chapter as the seven woes. Maybe you've heard that said before. Because Jesus repeatedly condemns them over and over. The seven woes. Woe to you. And I'm not going to go through them all because it would take too long. But I do want to summarize them a little bit for you as we go through this. And if you want to follow along, you can. I'm summarizing, so I'm not reading it verbatim. And hopefully I summarize it well enough to get the point across. But in verses 2 through 4, and this is in, again, Matthew 23, Jesus revealed how they imposed strict rules on others, but did not follow them themselves. In verses 5 through 12, he condemns their love for status. They sought public praise, right? They honor rather than truly serving God. And then when we drop down to verses 13 through 26, he declared judgment upon them. Through the woes, again, woe to you. Remember, you can go back and read that. He showed how their actions led people away from the kingdom of God rather than toward it. In verses 27 and 28, he compared them to whitewashed tombs. He did that in another area too, but again, outwardly they appeared righteous. Outwardly they looked great. Man, you are shiny and bright and so new. But inwardly, they were full of corruption and dead works. And I'm going to skip down in verses 37 through 39, Jesus prophesied about their downfall. Again, if you get a chance to go back and read through that, it's a good read, and I think you can get some things out of it. Hopefully you can see a lot of things in that when you do that. But he foretold that their system of hypocrisy would lead to judgment, lamenting over Jerusalem for rejecting the truth. So Matthew 23, I think, is the ultimate, when we look through the things that we've read today so far, example of why Jesus warned about the leaven of the Pharisees. I hope you understand it. What he's trying to say, his condemnation aligns perfectly with the symbolism of leaven that we find in Exodus 12, where God is giving the Israelites instruction of how to keep their first days of unleavened bread. Let's go there as we close. Let's go to Exodus 12 in verse 15. Exodus 12 and verse 15. Seven days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. For whoever eats unleavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. Physical leaven, right? That's what we're talking about. That's what it's talking about here. Remove the leaven. Or is it just the physical? Verse 19 says, for 7 days no leaven shall be found in your house. Since whoever eats it, what is leavened, that same person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a native of the land. You shall eat nothing leavened. In your dwellings you shall eat unleavened bread. Again, physical, right? Unleavened bread. But it's also spiritual, isn't it? No leaven, no sin in your household. Now, yes, it's 7 days he talks about, but we know that's something that we should work on always, right? No leaven in my household. So we have to realize and look at that. This is not just a physical thing that we see here. This is a spiritual thing. This is something that you and I have to look deep within our hypocrisy, teachings, doctrine that we've understood, or maybe doctrines that we've misunderstood in teachings. Do we understand what Christ is really saying here in what we've talked about? Do we understand that combining the two elements that he describes and that we looked at to his disciples is the leaven of the Pharisees? Do we see that? And did we see that in there? You know, I pray as we come to the Spring Holy Days, just a few weeks away, I hope that we will meditate more on what these things mean between not just the physical, but the spiritual also. To look at ourselves and look at our spiritual leaven, and as if there's anything that we need to remove at this higher level. Not just the crumbs that are in the car. And we know that generally when we're cleaning for the unleavened bread, we're looking for the crumbs. We're looking, and you know that we'll never ever find them all. Because they hide. They're in places we can't get to. But that's the same thing as spiritual leaven, isn't it? It gets into those places, into our minds, into our hearts that we don't really look at sometimes, that we don't see, that we don't discern. And God is, in Jesus Christ, are telling us that you need to discern what these things are. You need to understand what these things are and get the crumbs out of the heart, of the mind, the way we think. So I hope that this helps. Hope that this gives us a little more things to think about and renew ourselves as we come to the spring holy days. And I hope that you have a wonderful rest of the Sabbath.